Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. President Obama's unexpected and historic announcement to reestablish U.S. relations with Cuba is receiving wall-to-wall media coverage. It's the most significant shift in U.S. policy towards Cuba in 50 years. Next month, the president will use broad executive power to lift restrictions on travel, commerce, and financial activities. That's according to administration officials. They put the word out yesterday. The president is also going to have a press conference in about 20 minutes, and he's expected to include more details about Cuba. Many journalists say that at this point, details are fairly scarce. So how will this announcement change U.S. media coverage of Cuba? And then on Monday, President Obama signed a massive spending bill. The $1.1 trillion bill affects everything from abortion to campaign finance. The bill got a lot of attention, but most of it was focused on the political infighting. Where are the actual details of what is in the bill? The Washington Post had a good piece, What's in the Bill? We skim it so you don't have to. And this article was 15 pages. And then where is information about the $584 billion military spending bill? That got very little attention, but it includes a lot of really important information on land, which is very rare, but land bills couldn't pass on their own, so they were put in this military spending bill. And we'll talk about that with today's guest. Michael McAuliffe is senior congressional reporter with the Huffington Post, and he's been watching these spending bills very closely. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for bringing me on again.
Great to have you. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of a number of books, including Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else, and Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me again, Rose.
Great to have you. And Kevin Hall is chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. McClatchy publishes papers across the country, including here in California, the Sacramento Bee and the Fresno Bee. And Kevin was last in Cuba in 2012. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give a reporter some kudos. So Michael McAuliffe with the Huffington Post, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, there was a great story in the National Journal sort of about Carl Eikenberry, the former ambassador to Afghanistan, but also the commander of U.S. forces there. And it looks at how he sort of changed from being very happy with the United States all-volunteer army to seeing now that the fact that it is all-volunteer and it doesn't represent everybody in the society, it gets overlooked not overseen by Congress the way it used to. And he sees it sort of potentially becoming much less effective and hollowed out, and it's kind of tragic. But it is a long story, and it sort of looks at this evolving change through Eikenberry's own sort of experiences, and it was very interesting. And you know, there's all sorts of stuff in there about Charlie Rangel's efforts to try and bring back the draft, so that the country has more of a stake in when its sons and daughters go off to war. And it was just an interesting way to look at it, and we haven't really thought about that very much.
And what does Eikenberry agree with that? Would he bring back a draft?
Yeah, he's very much interested in something that gets the whole country to have a stake in war again, and not just have these sort of ridiculous polemic debates on the floor of the House. I mean, right now there's new activity going on in Iraq and in Syria, and the Congress has not actually voted to authorize that activity, even though it's well after the 90 days that the president's supposed to have under the War Powers Act. They didn't even bother to really debate it.
Hmm. Sounds interesting. So kudos to the National Journal. Thank you for that one, Michael.
Sure.
What about you, Kevin Hall with McClatchy? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know, the Washington Post has had a nice series on middle-class income. For interest in brevity, I won't go into great detail, but they did a nice piece of tracking one worker who started in the aerospace industry and kind of tracking him through his career, both on earnings and kind of the state of his industry. Very well done.
And so what's the focus of the piece? Just about how the struggle of middle-class workers and how things have changed so much?
Yeah, the struggle for dignified middle-class incomes, I guess, as well, professions.
And so that was a series?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we'll find that at the Washington Post. And what about you, David? David K. Johnston, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, NPR had a really delightful story on a totally different note this morning about a little boy who saw an ad for Sears back in 1955. He dials the telephone number as published in the Colorado Springs Gazette, and who answers the phone but the U.S. Air Force colonel, who's the key person if we're going to launch the nukes and attack the Soviet Union. And initially he's like, "Hey, what are you doing here, kid?" And then when the kid starts crying, he decides to play Santa Claus. And that is the incident which led to every year DORAD, you know, supposedly tracking Santa and his reindeer coming over from the North Pole. And the Air Force actually has people answer telephones as Santa on Christmas Eve. And that was at NPR. It was a beautifully told, fun little story that I recommend to anybody to put a smile on your face.
Well, and so according to this piece, kids can still call this number today.
That's right. The you and I as taxpayers put up a little bit of money for some folks to answer the phone and pretend to be Santa Claus. But I think that's a terrific little story about humanity. And it came from the three children, all now in their 50s and 60s, of the colonel who told it to NPR. Has this story corps where they go and find stories like this.
Yeah.
And this is one of the most delightful features that they've done. And there is a print version of it that I've sent your staff a link to.
All right, thank you. I love StoryCorps.
Your enormous staff of hundreds of people.
That's right. We all got it this morning. And if you have a child in your life, or maybe you want to call Santa Claus, the number is 877-446-6723. Thank you for that, David. And we will put links to all of these stories, along with the number to call Santa Claus, at yourcallradio.org. All right, so let's dive in and talk about this very unexpected and historic announcement made by President Obama to reestablish U.S. relations with Cuba. It's receiving wall-to-wall coverage. Kevin, you were last in Cuba in 2012. You have said that, for the most part, the specific details are scarce, but this is an historic announcement.
Yeah, without a doubt, it is historic for many reasons, not the least of which is I don't think anybody can remember when something actually stayed secret through the whole process, which this did. This has been months in the making. It was initiated through some contacts from the Pope Francis and kind of went from there. There are a lot of things happening globally that kind of helped this along, from the death of Chavez to the coal and oil prices to a lot of other things. But Cuba is really on a bad way. And there is no turning back, I think, from this. Some of the concern has been, well, are you rewarding the Castro brothers? They're 88 and 83, respectively. They don't have a lot of shelf life. They don't really have a clear succession of power. And I think the Obama administration, without saying it, what they're really after is to have some level of context so that when one or both of the brothers die, you don't just collapse into chaos 90 miles off, you know, the shore of Key West.
And, Kevin, you point out that this is not the first move Obama has made on Cuba, but what he's done over the years has been fairly quiet. A lot of people don't even know about what he changed from the Bush administration.
Yeah, I think outside of Miami, I think most people were probably unaware of how he's quietly. The Bush administration decided they were going to squeeze, take a tough approach with Cuba and squeeze the economy further. So people could only visit once every 3 years instead of annually. I think they were limited to $1,000 a year in providing to relatives, et cetera. You know, Obama quietly changed that in 2009 and then in 2011, two different steps that made it easier. You could go, I think, up to four times a year, if I'm not mistaken. You could give large sums of money, and they weren't limited to giving money to direct relatives. You could pretty much give it to anybody you wanted. So what was really noticeable when I was there, I had been there in 96, and then again in 2012, I drove one end of the island to the other, you know, for about an eight-day period, and basically just gave Cubans rides everywhere in Bayamo and or Gein and kind of places that most people have never heard of, and really got a sense of kind of where they are. One thing that was striking is I couldn't find a single Cuban, and I gave rides to federal judges, to farmers, to you name it. There wasn't one person who could name a natural successor to the Castro brothers. And it's striking. There have been no civilian organizations, civil institutions. The Roman Catholic Church has really stepped into the void in the last decade or so and really played that role in providing business training classes and things of that sort. But short of sex tourism, which is rampant, there really isn't much else going on there.
Well, because you've been there, I mean, we get this picture of Cuba. Castro's the face. It's portrayed as a very poor country, a friend of Venezuela. At the same time, there's also a romanticism of pre-revolutionary Cuba. So what are your thoughts about how Cuba is portrayed in the U.S. media, and how do you think it'll change because of this announcement?
Yeah, well, having spent most of my career in Latin America, how the Latin America media views Cuba versus how the American media views Cuba is an interesting dichotomy in itself. I mean, I think some parts, the Sean Penn visit and things of that sort, kind of romanticize Cuba. But I think, you know, the reality, once it really does open up, you think Vietnam is a great example, once you kind of bridge that divide in terms of diplomatic relations and recognizing each other, Cuba has no choice but to liberalize. It's going to happen in some way, shape, or form. One thing that's striking, if you go to Honduras or El Salvador or any poor country in the hemisphere, you have people fix tires, mechanics, salons. Everybody scrapes a living somehow. There is no such thing in Cuba. You don't see that. It's now about 181 jobs have just in the last 3 years legalized. You have your own hair cutting place out of your house, but this is all in its infancy, so it is going to be a monumental challenge kind of bringing them into the modern world, so to speak.
That is Kevin Hall. He's he's chief economics correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. We already have a couple emails on Cuba and a phone call. We'll talk about this for about 10 more minutes. So if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. David, we have an email about economics. I think you'd be good for this one. Leslie writes, now that Cuba's back in the news, it would behoove politicians and pundits to recognize the distinction between economic systems and political systems, formulating the difference between Cuba and the U.S. as the difference between socialism and democracy, as I've already heard on NPR, involves the quintessential apples and oranges conundrum. We have different economic systems, socialism and capitalism, neither in a pure form, but that's another issue. Which economic system is most conducive to democracy is a question for debate, but first we have to define our terms correctly. What are your thoughts on that, David?
Well, Cuba is a dictatorship run by the two brothers, and as Michael's pointed out, there's no natural successor we've seen, which has got to be a major factor influencing what the Obama administration is doing here. But we misuse labels all the time. And also, you know, you see all these attacks on Obama because he's giving something to a dictator. Good grief, we deal with dictators everywhere. All over the world. Why are we dealing with Cuba differently? Because of the power and influence of the Cuban-American community, particularly in Miami, who since the Bay of Pigs haven't been willing to sacrifice one of their sons to kill the guy if they think he's that awful. But we're going to see a whole lot of changes. The U.S. is the natural market for Cuba. It's not too far away because it's easy for Obama to change trade and tourism regulations. Investment requires some congressional action, and the Chinese and the Canadians are busy investing because they understand as soon as Cuba opens up to the U.S., the enormous profits to be made there, and I suspect some of the other Caribbean governments are very worried about what will happen to their business because Cuba will, once its infrastructure is built up, will be very attractive. But, you know, let's not worry about labels. Let's accept the reality that change is coming here. We're going to see a lot of investment. Cuba is a country that has allowed now currently all sorts of small entrepreneurs. Virtually all the tobacco products made there are done by little entrepreneurs. And, you know, the world is going to change, and this policy that dates back to the very last days of the Eisenhower administration is going to come to an end with big changes that will affect both the U.S. and Cuba and all the other tourist places in the Caribbean.
Well, thank you for the email, Leslie. We have a phone call from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Regarding Obama's new policy concerning Cuba, the new Republican Congress follows the long-running anti-Castro policy. What can really change since the Helms-Burton Act will still be law?
Well, Michael, you wrote about this. The lead, Marco Rubio, fires back on Cuba. He said, Obama is the worst negotiator in my lifetime. Shortly after the announcement, a lot of the coverage focused on Republican reaction. And Rubio vowed in a blistering press conference that Obama will get no money for this policy, no ambassador will be confirmed, and the embargo will never be lifted.
Well, that's exactly what he said, and he's probably correct, but I just have a sneaking suspicion that as things go along and people get used to this idea, some of that resistance will fade. Now, remember that one of the people who was on that plane bringing Alan Gross back from Cuba was Republican Senator Jeff Flake. And you had one of the 2016 aspirants in Rand Paul out there, at least somewhat supportive of this policy. So, you know, things have a way of changing very quickly in U.S. politics once it starts to go. And let's see what the mood is actually like as we get closer to the next election and see if Congress is as adamantly opposed to this as they are right now. I think they'll probably still stay opposed, but I bet you they start thawing.
And you mentioned Alan Gross. He's an American subcontractor who worked for USAID. He was arrested in 2009 and sentenced to 15 years. He's been held in a Cuban prison for 5 years, accused of spying. And his release was negotiated in exchange for the freeing of three Cubans, three of the Cuba Five. So I just wanted to point that out. David, did you want to jump in? Or was that Kevin?
It was Kevin.
Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, I guess there were just a couple of points. One, we keep talking about how we're going to react on our side, but a lot of this depends on what the Cuban motives really are. And I think there are some who are skeptical, and they remember back to the Mario boat lift and how Carter sought rapprochement with Cuba and became, you know, kind of national laughing stock for how Castro emptied out the prisons and the mental institutions and sent them all over in the Mario boat lift. So I think there is a certain hold-your-breath quality to this, but I do think the economy is so bad off. One thing that you know, in the 80s under Reagan, you had Radio Marti, and you had all this propaganda pushed at them. In today's wired world, Cubans have access to U.S. TV. They watch it. I was stunned. This federal judge that I gave a ride to had watched every episode of Jack Bauer 24 and knew all this stuff. I hadn't seen these things, and she knew more about popular culture than I did. So they're seeing this. It's not filtered. It's not nearly as filtered as we think it is.
Well, what are your thoughts about the announcement we got from the administration yesterday about President Obama using executive power to defy these critics in Congress and lift restrictions on travel, commerce, and financial activities?
He certainly has the power to do that, and one of the things that we're not getting, and maybe my colleagues can chime in on this, but we're not getting a lot of details as to where the gray area. They're trying not to show their hand. A lot of this will be done through announcements in the Federal Register, and they're probably not going to be, you know, publicizing a lot of this stuff well in advance, but they have, Helms-Burton actually gives a lot of discretion to the executive office. So that's one area, even though the Helms-Burton law that restricts, you know, satellites of U.S. companies or people who do business in the U.S. and do it in Cuba, it's already full of loopholes, and now you add the discretion into it, and I think he's got a lot of room to move.
Rose, David here, there are a lot of American businesses that want to sell products to Cuba and that Cuba wants, and they can't do it with any financing right now. Things have to be paid for cash in advance. That's going to be one of the big shifts, and the business interests here are going to triumph over this ridiculous idea that we can't do anything with Cuba because it's a dictatorship. Because if that were the case, we wouldn't do anything with Saudi Arabia, a whole host of other countries around the world, including Russia and China.
China.
So the business interests are going to drive this, and I think you're going to see very rapid change on everything except investment. That's the one area where Congress has absolute power, and to hold back U.S. investment in Cuba is to say we'd like to help the Chinese and the Canadians and the Europeans grow wealthy off the investments from American trade and tourism.
All right.
You see that right up the coast, Rose. You see that right up on the coast. Canadian and Chinese companies are drilling right offshore, just north of west of Havana, and they're there.
All right. Well, thank you for the phone call. Let's go next to Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah. Hi, Rose. I'm with Global Exchange, and we take about 40 group trips a year to Cuba. We've been doing it for 25 years now. We've seen the progression of Cuba. What people need to think about is our responsibility is not Cuba. It's U.S. foreign policy, and the U.S. foreign policy of aggression. The CIA introduced a swine virus into the Cuban pig population in the 1970s that killed half the Cuban pig population. Cuba never attacked the United States, and yet we've done all this aggression against them. So what I advise people is go. You can go to Cuba. Global Exchange goes with a license, globalexchange.org, and you can see for yourself. And we talk to Cubans who love socialism, who hate Fidel, who don't care either way. And then you make up your own mind as a U.S. citizen. What should our policy be? And most people come down on the side of, let's be friends. Let's have normal relations.
Your next trip is Valentine's Day, right?
Well, we have a New Year's trip, but you'd be too late to sign up for that. And the New Year's party in Cuba, it tops any New Year's party I've ever been to in the United States. They recycle everything. They went organic as a nation in their agriculture. They shifted to bicycles when the Soviet petrochemicals got cut off. All sorts of changes that we could learn from. They're further down the road to sustainability than we are here. They don't have young black men being shot dead in the streets by police. They don't rank number one in the world for spousal murder, which the United States does. So what you're hearing from the critics of this policy is the last gasp of imperial culture, that we have the right to tell other countries how to run their country.
Well, thank you for calling. That's Kevin Danaher, a co-founder of Global Exchange. They take people on reality tours around the world, and one of those tours is to Cuba. Kevin, we have about a minute left. What about that side of the story?
About the U.S. repression?
Both what Kevin talked about, the both U.S. foreign policy and then what he talked about in terms of what he sees on his reality tours. And a lot
yeah,
of,
I mean, I,
go ahead.
I think those exchanges, I think people will see. I mean, I found it very, I mean, I had already been there, so I was able to kind of compare before and after. But I do think when you sit down and talk with people there, you take a very different approach. I think they're largely apolitical people. Anybody who had a problem with the regime, for the most part, has gone there. Obviously, there's some dissent, but most people have had avenues to leave and have gone to Spain or have gone to the United States. I think most everyone else, NPR had a very telling interview from there where one of the dissident bloggers had noted the first thing his neighbor asked was, can I still get meat? Hmm. Because meat is rationed by the government. So that, you know, their first concern was, you know, can I at least have what little meat I'm getting, can I still get that? That it's going to be a kind of a creeping reality that's going to, you know, shift over time. And I think that one of the keys is to manage this and not basically just have kind of an onslaught of people coming over and taking over the country. That will lead to resentment. So,
well, yeah, and we'll definitely do a show about this in the new year. We just got an email from Lisa who says, why do we assume this will be good for Cubans? So that's another question to ask. Kevin Hall is chief economics correspondent for McClatchy. Kevin, thanks so much. I know you're about to go on vacation. Have a good holiday. Thank you.
Great. Happy holidays to everybody.
Thanks. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in the weekly media roundtable on your call. On the phone, it's 866-798-TALK. Toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can send an email if you prefer that. The address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. The Tavis Smiley Show today at noon. And then at 1 o'clock, Latino USA.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with Sanjay Rowell, director of Food Chains, a documentary about the plight of immigrants who pick tomatoes in Immokalee, Florida, and their battle with supermarkets and fast food companies. Farm workers are among the lowest paid workers in the U.S., so how are they organizing for fair wages? There's a lot of success stories in this documentary. I hope you can see it over the holiday. And today, it's our media roundtable. We are going to talk about media coverage of the massive $1.1 trillion spending bill, which got a lot of coverage, and then also the $584 billion military spending bill, which didn't get much attention at all. We'll talk about that with Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional reporter with the Huffington Post, David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, best-selling author of a number of books, including Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. So let's talk about the $1.1 trillion spending bill. I just want to go over the votes because I think this is really important. The House passed the bill 219 to 206. It was opposed by 67 Republicans and 139 Democrats. The Senate passed the bill 56 to 40. 22 Dems, 18 Republicans voted no. Four did not vote. Senator Barbara Boxer voted no. Senator Dianne Feinstein did not vote. Michael, this did get a lot of media attention, but it seemed like the majority focused on the political infighting. I heard over and over again that the, quote, fringes on both sides decided to go against President Obama and John Boehner. And in many cases, I didn't hear any details. It was just so much was the focus of political infighting. What was your read on it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the way we cover a lot of stuff, is sort of more of a sports match and who wins and who loses rather than, you know, what the actual substance of the bill is. And, I mean, there's just so much that you could talk about. I mean, this is the reason that they did this in the first place is that Congress was unable to pass its appropriations bills all through the year, and we're actually 3 months into the fiscal year already. So this is way overdue, and they jammed it all together and filled it up with all sorts of riders that really do merit some attention. And it's not easy to get folks to pay attention to that when all you hear about is, you know, Boehner won or Boehner quelled the Tea Party or whatever the meme of the day happens to be.
And David, in your excellent piece, I love the title, The Hunger Games Economy, you said no public hearings, no public debate. Instead, as we saw in North Carolina and Wisconsin, it occurs with just abrupt moves to shift power and money from the many to the richest few. And Congresswoman Louise Slaughter was quoted as saying, quote, there's some things I think I really have to say about this, mostly process. 1,600 pages released in the middle of the night. Not one member of the committee has been able to read all the way through it or anything of it. No opportunity for public input, no hearings, no markups, and no time to adequately consider $1.1 trillion in spending. How transparent was this?
Oh, not at all. And the troubling part is very important things happened here that got almost no coverage. My column points out, for example, that since 1974, under the ERISA Act, the Pension Protection Act, pensions have been guaranteed. There's limits and rules on them, but they were guaranteed. This bill allows already retired workers up to the age of 74 years and 11 months to have their pensions cut if they're in multi-employer plans. And by the way, the big plans that are likely to fail, almost certain to fail, they're going to fail in about 15 years.
Wow.
So there wasn't a pressing need to do this. It was that the people who wanted to do this didn't want a policy debate about it. And there are, you know, cuts to the IRS. I mean, the IRS is half the size it was to the economy and the number of taxpayers from a decade ago, and this was a huge gift to very high-income tax cheats because the tax system for workers is all automated. You can't cheat, basically. But for very high-income people, audits will be fewer, and they will be much lighter. This was full of this kind of stuff, and for all the complaints you hear about, gee, government doesn't care about people, wow! This bill, this is just horrendous, not just because, as my column points out, we're redistributing upward. This is all these provisions that take from the many to benefit the few, but because of the nature of how it was done. And we should all be really offended by this. This is not how government should work. It shouldn't happen with middle-of-the-night bills, with no public hearings, where even as Louise Slaughter, who happens to be my congresswoman, points out, nobody knew what they were voting on.
Right. Well, so David, how should reporters tell people what's in this bill, because again, 1,600 pages, the Washington Post did a pretty good job in their what's in the spending bill. We skim it so you don't have to. It's 15 long pages. But then again, at the same time, when you're looking at the Internal Revenue Service, they basically write two sentences about it, and none of the details that you just mentioned are in this.
Right.
To find information on the pension, Labor Notes is one of the only outlets that has an entire article just about the attack on pensions. So,
and so, by the way, having crossed that bridge, you're going to see your pension, if you're lucky enough to have one, if the pension plan is in trouble, the government's response is, we're not going to keep our promises and our guarantees, which all flow from the failure to put in the amount of money required, because we know how to fund pensions, and that's because Congress allowed companies to not put in the required amount, which made the executives richer on their stock options. I think what reporters should have done in the leads of all their stories is said that they're passing this midnight bill no one has read. They should have focused on that part of the process. And instead, there are all these people who get paid on Capitol Hill to go around and, you know, tell reporters this or that, the talking points way of coverage. And the journalists should have just stepped back and written stories pointing out what an awful process this was. Mm-hmm. And made it eminently clear to people instead. And by the way, the Washington Post did quite good work on this. It did much better work than my two former big papers, the LA Times and the New York Times. But overall, the coverage in TV and everywhere else was not about what really mattered here. And that's part of the problem with Washington coverage.
And Michael, you're a senior congressional reporter. You're in Washington. What do you hear from colleagues when a huge bill comes out like this? How do they decide how to focus on it and what to focus on?
Well, what they do is they focus on the top line things. Because just like he was saying, you get these talking points that are sent out by the Fox that say it has 20 different things in it, and you've got to do it in a quick hurry, so people do that and they move on. But I got to say, just in terms of the whole process, we had reporters who were very interested in specific things, like our Shaheen Nasir report was looking at Pell Grants. Mm. And there's provision that he had heard that might go in there to shift some of the money for Pell Grants to the loan servicers, who notoriously do a terrible job. So you get less money for the students, more money for the loan servicers. And this is something that Tom Harkin, a liberal that most progressives really like, wanted to do. So he and I tried to get some information about this, not too long before it came out. But all we got told was, well, I can't talk about that right now. There's still negotiations. There's all kinds of items in there that we were looking for that were like that. And they won't tell you, even when you ask very specific questions about an item, you don't get an answer, because they don't want the public to know what is actually going to go in there, because then you might get a reaction against it.
That is Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional reporter with the Huffington Post. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He writes a column for Al Jazeera America. He's also reported for the New York Times and the LA Times. So I'm sure you heard a lot of coverage about the budget bill. What stood out for you? Do you know what's in it? If you have any questions about it, we'd love to hear from you. We're also going to talk about the massive military spending bill that recently passed. That got hardly any attention. There's a lot of important information in that bill affecting land. So give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now, some of the more important things that did happen behind the scenes is that President Obama made calls to Democrats along with J.P. Morgan's chief executive, according to the Washington Post. Jamie Dimon telephoned lawmakers to urge them to vote for the bill. And Congresswoman Maxine Waters, had a number of Dems in her office saying, no, we will not vote for this. So there are some details behind the scenes, David, that definitely deserve more coverage, but I still didn't hear much more about J.P. Morgan's CEO Jamie Dimon making phone calls. And who was he calling exactly, and what did he say? I mean, what do you think a reporter should do in this instance?
Well, this was a very significant piece of news, that here we have whipping done not by the leadership of the party, but by Jamie Dimon. totally self-interested here, wanting back the ability to reopen the derivatives casino under rules that bets that pay off the bankers keep and bets that lose may end up being paid off by you and me as taxpayers. This should have gotten, I think, a great deal more coverage. Part of the problem is that most reporters who cover politics, including Capitol Hill, are not deeply steeped in economics. They don't know regulatory law. The number of journalists, who understand regulatory law and what this really means and economics is just a small section of the overall group of remaining reporters doing beat work. I think this Jamie Dimon's phone call is a tremendously important story that should have gotten a lot more attention. I mentioned it in my column for National Memo called the Hunger Games Economy, but that's all because I'm writing a column about the broader trend here.
And so what else? I mean, Wall Street was in favor of this bill. What else does this do for Wall Street and banking? What else do we need to know about that didn't get much coverage?
Fundamentally, what's gone wrong, we've regulated banking for 4,000 years. It's not like we don't know how to regulate banking. Unfortunately, we've gotten this idea that bankers should be trusted. And after the 2008 meltdown, I don't know why this possibly got passed, except for all the money and lobbying money, campaign money and lobbying money and jobs for people around a congressman who need to do favors for people, that the banking industry is in a position to control. The basic issue in this case is banks were not able to use the paycheck you deposit under Dodd-Frank to gamble with derivatives. Now they can again. And so if you've got $250,000, you're okay. You're covered by FDIC insurance, but the taxpayers may end up having to put up that money for the insurance. So think about this in the context now of the pensions. Government is going to allow existing pensioners up to 74 years old to have their pensions reduced if they were in multi-employer plans. These are blue-collar workers, truck drivers, carpenters, not people we think of as sophisticated about finance. And on the other side, after saying, no, we can take from you, we're now going to provide a government guarantee and all the moral hazard to very sophisticated bankers. Those two provisions, if I were still at the New York Times covering things like this, that would have been the thing I would have tried to get past the editors of the New York Times. I suspect it would have been very hard.
Why?
Because the Times is on things like this extremely conservative and wants to be the official record and is not prone to point out these direct contradictions in those kinds of terms. That's why I write reported to columns now for Al Jazeera and Tax Analysts and National Memo because I have the freedom to do that.
And the derivatives provision was written by Citigroup. Mother Jones...
Word for word. Mother Jones got a hold of the memo, and you can go to Mother Jones' website, and it's word for word. They wrote this thing as Elizabeth Warren, pointed out and tried to build a coalition to stop this. And used her substantial moral authority to do this. Elizabeth Warren is our Teddy Roosevelt. And if she were in the White House, we would see serious changes happen. She is in favor of business. She is against crony capitalism, and she has a tremendous track record of being expert, thoughtful, smart about this.
Michael, did the fact that this provision get written by Citigroup get much attention in D.C.?
Well, it did get a bit of attention, and I heard it mentioned in some of those speeches, including by Senator Warren, but not really a whole lot. I mean, you had to be looking at media that are not necessarily the New York Times to find that information. It was out there pretty widespread, but it was definitely not the focus of most of the coverage.
And Elizabeth Warren, when she was speaking to the banks, she said, "We should have broken you into pieces." Now, what about the campaign finance provision? This bill would dramatically expand the amount of money that wealthy political donors could inject into the national parties, drastically undercutting McCain-Feingold, a donor who gave the maximum $32,400 this year to the Dems or the Republicans, would be able to donate another $291,000 on top of that. So it's a total of $324,000. Michael, that's pretty significant.
Yeah, that is pretty significant, and some of the folks who were opposed to this in the debates, and they nearly sank this bill in the rule in a procedural vote, but a number of them pointed out that what you're essentially doing is you're allowing bankers to make more money, and then you're letting them reward the politicians who help them make more money by giving that money to their political parties. So there's an interesting contrast there, and again, it nearly sank the bill on a procedural vote, but John Boehner was able to twist enough arms on his side to have it passed by, I believe, Carrie Bentivoglio was the final guy to switch, and he used to play Santa Claus, so it worked well for the folks who didn't like it to say it's a Christmas present for bankers.
And what about how this affects the environment? Think Progress had a good piece, six of the worst environmental provisions of the spending bill. David, you included a bit of this in your piece. Under the bill, the EPA would be allowed an $8.1 billion budget, $60 million less than what they got last year. There's blocking regulation of lead ammunition. The spending bill includes a provision that would prohibit federal funds going toward regulation of lead and ammunition. It's got big implications, because when hunters use lead bullets and leave carcasses in the woods, the lead can harm the birds and scavengers. California bans this, but that's a very big deal. It didn't get much attention. More coal-fired power plants, less renewable energy, preventing funding to the green climate change. What else do we need to know about how this affects the environment, David?
I'm not an authority on the details of this bill, but the provisions that you brought up, which I am familiar with, those are significant because the first one about lead in bullets represents, yet again, the power of the gun manufacturers and their capture of the National Rifle Association to get whatever way they want. And they simply will not anywhere under their current leadership see any kind of reasonable regulation. This other issue of coal-fired power plants, we're going to see, despite the efforts of the energy industry to manipulate the process, which I've been writing a lot about Al Jazeera this year, you're going to see major changes coming because fracked gas is so cheap. Nuclear power plants that were highly profitable, they were taken over, run by people who used to run Navy submarine nuclear power plants and were running at 90-95% of their capacity instead of the traditional utility model of about 60%. They're trying to shut those down. Coal-fired power plants are being shut down because the rules we now have on quote-unquote markets for electricity, they're faux markets, will drive up the price of electricity during peak demand in summer or winter. And so everything with the EPA that deals with coal, you need to think of in the context of how Wall Street is trying, through its ownership and investments in the quote-unquote electric markets, make you pay more, not less. And without regulators, you will pay more and you will have less reliable service. Absolutely guaranteed.
And the Washington Post, going back to the EPA, reports that the EPA's budget has been slashed by $2.2 billion since 2010. These latest cuts mean the EPA will have to reduce its staffing to lowest levels since 1989. That's significant.
And this is going on all through our government. We have fewer wage and hour inspectors today by numbers than we did in 1940, when the population was about half what it is today. And so surprise, surprise, all over the country there's wage theft going on where employers are cheating workers out of their pay with impunity.
And the New York Times just reported that Walmart has to pay back past wages.
Yes, and I'm sure that compared to the total wages they didn't pay, you know, it's a nick. It's not the total amount. But think about that. The biggest private employer in this country has practices that routinely cheat its workers. So do McDonald's and the other big fast food companies. Walmart in particular was nailed for locking workers inside, supposedly for their safety. Remember, it was the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory where people were locked inside that got us workers' compensation laws more than a century ago. If you don't have police who are making sure the rules are followed, all sorts of employers, even one as big as Walmart, will thumb their nose at the law, and that's why you need to have regulation, because it's not for the good actors, it's for the bad actors, and it's to protect the powerless.
Also in the bill once again bans use of federal funding to perform most abortions, blocks the use of local and federal funding for abortions in the District of Columbia, blocks the use of federal dollars for abortions for federal prisoners. Republicans also put language in there directing the Secretary of Health and Human Services to ensure that citizens shopping for health care coverage on the federal exchange can tell whether a plan covers abortion services. And before we move on to the military spending bill, Michael, is there anything else in the $1.1 trillion spending bill that we need to know about?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that's sort of a pet focus of mine, and it's not in there, and that's money for the next census, for the decennial census. It's supposed to be done more cheaply than it was done in 2010, and it came in slightly under budget at $13 billion, and it's gotten roughly twice as expensive as the previous time for about the last three or four censuses. So they were trying to do all kinds of new ways to gather information using public records, using the internet, but they need to test these things to make sure they actually work properly before they do them for a project counting, you know, more than 300 million Americans. The money to fund that is not in there. It's $123 million less than what the White House thought was needed, and which some experts thought was insufficient to begin with. But that money is not in there at all. They'll have to cut back on the testing of these new programs, and I would guess that in two or three years they're going to figure out that they're in no position to be able to do the census for what they have budgeted for it, because they're going to need lots of expensive man hours or person hours, I guess, to go out and actually find people physically.
Why do you think this is so important, just briefly?
Well, because the census is the basis for nearly all of our economic statistics, for handing out our government funding for all kinds of programs for states, counties, municipalities. And unless you get the numbers right, you don't know where the money needs to go. You don't know what the issues that need to be solved are. So if it's wrong, it's a huge disaster.
Mm. Well, so we've got about 4 minutes left, and I just wanted to ask you about the $584 billion military spending bill, which also passed, was it this week or last week?
Well, it just finished the Senate this past week.
Okay. And you have been reporting on a really interesting provision of this. I mean, the bill itself didn't get much attention, but there are a lot of important land provisions in the military spending bill, and I understand that they were added to this bill because they couldn't get passed on their own. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, there's all sorts of local issues that members of Congress have been trying to deal with for years, and they all complain that nobody cares about their issue. It can't get support. They can't pass, you know, they want to preserve, a Harriet Tubman Museum in Maryland or whatever it is, and they can't get it passed because there's not support for it. So what they ended up doing is lumping a whole bunch of these things together, some 100 different sort of measures into one huge thing. Preservationists, conservationists liked a lot of it, but there are two in there that folks really don't like. And one is this Arizona land swap where they give 2,400 acres in the Tonto National Forest to a mining company, a giant mining company that has the dubious distinction of owning a uranium mine with Iran in Africa. Iran won't benefit from this copper mine in Arizona, but nevertheless, it doesn't look great, and this land is considered sacred by a couple of Native American tribes, including the Apaches, and when you dig this copper out from underneath there, it's just going to collapse, and it'll be gone. But it got stuck in there. It went to the House floor twice in this last Congress, and there wasn't enough support to pass it. But there it is in there. And there's another one which I know a little bit less about. It's a huge deal to give 70,000 acres of the Tongass Forest in Alaska to a corporation there that's supposed to help Native Americans. Conservationists say they're going to probably log about 70,000 of that acres, and that won't be a good thing.
Anything else strike you about this military spending bill? Is it much of the same of what we've seen in the last couple of years?
Well, yeah, it is. There's all these things that the administration didn't ask for that are in there, and don't ask me to get too detailed on it because you need to be pretty well versed in defense spending to get it exactly right. But I mean, I noticed that there's things like the F-35 fighter. Mm. Yeah, there's like $500 million extra in there to build more of them. There's weapon systems that the military doesn't want, but that they're built in various states. So of course those all get thrown in there. I mean, that's the same story that you've probably heard many times before.
Yes, we've covered the same thing many times before. Michael, what are you working on right now?
Well, actually, I'm working on a piece that looks at how secretive that whole process was, and I spoke to some folks who benefited from it, or at least I tried to, and said, well, how was it swallowing something like this copper mine deal in order to get what you wanted? And one of the people was Senator Tammy Baldwin, who actually campaigned 2 years ago by mentioning this company because her opponent was an investor in it. And wow. So I asked her, and she just looked at me and said, talk to my communications director.
Huh. And this bill passed the Senate 89-11, just 11. Yeah. David, what about you? What are you working on now?
I've been working for some time on a project about the real cost of putting a police officer on the street. It'll appear in Newsweek, and it will knock your socks off what the real cost is. When you read about police salaries being in many cities now in the high five figures, in some cases around $100,000, that's just part of the bill.
Huh. All right. We'll look for that and have you on soon. Thank you so much. David K. Johnston, or I should say have you on again. David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, and Michael McAuliffe, senior congressional reporter with the Huffington Post. Thank you both for joining us. Have a nice holiday.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What is the human cost of our food supply? On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with Sanjay Rawal, director of Food Chains, a documentary about the plight of immigrants who pick tomatoes in Immokalee, Florida, and their battle with supermarkets and fast food companies. Farm workers are among the lowest paid workers in the U.S., so how are they organizing for fair wages? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.